Welcome to Farmed and Dangerous, a long-term memory radio series on the pharmaceutical industry in Canada. In this hour, we focus on patient protection, scientific integrity, and the influence of corporate agendas on drug industry-funded research in top-notch Canadian research universities and underfunded third-world hospitals. Our guests are Dr. Nancy Oliveri, medical researcher at the University of Toronto and the Hospital for Sick Children, and Dr. Peter Lurie, deputy director of the Public Citizens Health Research Group, a nonprofit consumer advocacy organization based in Washington, D.C.
A committee of inquiry into the dispute involving Dr. Nancy Oliveri, the Hospital for Sick Children in Toronto, the University of Toronto, and the pharmaceutical company Apotex issued its report in October 2001. At that time, the report warned that tougher measures were needed to protect patients' rights and ensure that clinical drug trials are free from the influence of drug manufacturers. Dr. Nancy Oliveri is speaking to us from her office in Toronto. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Could you fill us in on the background of your case, please?
Sure. In 1993, we had been conducting trials in a drug for a very common blood disease called thalassemia, not common in North America, but very common worldwide. And in 1993, I signed a contract with a drug company called Apotex, which included a confidentiality clause that stated that I could not publish without their permission any data that arose from the trial. So that meant that there had been at least 4 years of work prior to Apotex's involvement. But in any event, we published favorable data in 1995, and later that year we found that the drug was not working as effectively as we had hoped in the past publication. And we told Apotex about this, and they told us that we were misinterpreting our own data and that we were not to tell patients, parents, or regulatory agencies or the scientific community about these findings. And to make a long story short, they threatened all legal remedies when we tried to present this to the patients, and they have since that time served legal remedies for damage to goods as well as libel to their product on me, and I've been in legal proceedings over this past summer for that. The university and the hospital joined ranks and attempted to dismiss me 4 times, as well as referring me publicly to the College of Physicians and Surgeons for alleged patient misconduct. That attempt was fruitless. The College of Physicians and Surgeons about 10 months ago found absolutely no basis to those allegations and said that my conduct had been commendable under difficult circumstances. Similarly, other accusations against me for research misconduct were discarded because of lack of foundation or evidence. During this time, we've been involved in several lawsuits. The hospital has issued several lawsuits against myself and vice versa, and those are ongoing. And the problem has gone on now for, I guess it's 6.5 years, with, even though it's away from the public view, it's still very, very much being actively fought here at the hospital.
Now, there are a lot of questions that come up.
I know.
Yes. First of all, was there a confidentiality agreement?
Actually, there wasn't. In the contract for the trial on which we reported our concerns, there was, in fact, no confidentiality agreement. The confidentiality agreement extended onto a different trial, but that was not picked up at the beginning. The hospital's advice was that the contract was probably enforceable, and they clearly didn't see the latter contract, which made null and void the earlier contract. So there was, in fact, no confidentiality agreement restricting my speech on this particular trial. Having said that, had that been intact, it would still be null and void because it violates public policy. There's no clause that can be legal under Canadian law in which I can be prevented from telling a patient about the harm to them. That doesn't mean that you always get fairly served, and now they've been in the legal system over 6 years. It's clear to me that anyone who does this takes it on at their own risk, going against the university, the hospital, and pharmaceutical companies.
Now, you mentioned that the hospital sued you. What was their reason for suing you?
Let's see. They've sued me on a number of occasions, as has the university, and those are still ongoing. It's probably better for me not to talk about those right now. There's tremendous hostility about this still, and since they're libel cases, I think it's better not to talk about it.
So these are the legal proceedings that you were talking about?
Yes, in part. Okay. The other proceedings are against Apotex and Apotex against myself, against the CDC for, and again, I can't discuss that because that would be compounding the libel. And then there is a big case in Europe during which Apotex submitted data on my trials to the European Committee to get the drug licensed. And we have sued the European Commission to bring to their attention the data that was, we believe, omitted from consideration. That is the data about our concerns.
Now, you published results criticizing the drug.
Well, no, I published results that found that there, I guess the short form of that might be criticizing the drug. You're correct. What we published was findings that suggested that over a third of patients were dangerously uncontrolled in terms of body iron burden, which is what the drug is being used for, to control body iron. And moreover, that in some proportion of patients, there appeared to be progression of liver damage while the patients were continuing on this drug. Again, we can't call cause and effect, and we didn't in that publication. We merely said that these findings needed to be confirmed in larger trials before the drug could be sold for clinical use.
How many patients were involved in the trial?
Oh, that's a long story. The original trial was 21. The later report was 18 because 3 had dropped out. It was a small trial.
Now, thalassemia, could you tell us just a little bit about it?
Sure. Thalassemia is a disorder of hemoglobin in which not sufficient amounts of hemoglobin are manufactured by the body. And the hemoglobin is the oxygen-carrying part of the red blood cell. And so if you don't have enough hemoglobin, you can't carry oxygen to your tissues. So most patients with severe thalassemia require transfusions from the first year of life. And as a result, transfusions administer a very large amount of iron to the system, which is toxic to the liver, heart, and other glands. And the only treatment for that is a drug that is infused under the skin 5 to 7 nights a week for a period of 8 to 12 hours. So it's an invasive kind of treatment. It saves lives, it preserves fertility, it allows people to grow up and have normal lives, but it's a very difficult treatment. And most patients would obviously prefer a drug to be orally active. And that was the thrust of our interest in the drug that ultimately Apotex set upon to develop. We had done trials in that for 5 years before they entered the scene. That is, the company entered the scene. But the original motivation was to try to develop a safe and effective orally active drug that would remove iron from the body of transfused patients.
Now, the name of the drug was
Deferiprone.
Is it still on the market?
Well, it isn't in the market in Canada, and it has been licensed in Europe for patients who cannot take the standard agent that I've just described, the infusions under the skin. That represents about 20 to 40 patients worldwide, so you might wonder why this is a problem. But the difficulty is that most patients, when faced with the choice between needles and pills, will say, I'm not able to take these needles. So there is only, to my knowledge, only one patient in Canada taking this drug. He is doing that under a special arrangement with Apotex. But there are none of my patients, and it is not licensed in Canada, nor is it licensed at the FDA.
Since the report came out last year, have there been any changes at all in terms of the protection?
Well, the party line is that everything's changed and had nothing to do with the Oliveri case. My interpretation of the quote-unquote new guidelines that David Naylor, the Dean of Medicine, has drawn up is that they appear to be as restrictive as the ones that antedated the Oliveri report. It's not clear, when one tries to clarify this, that one would be able to report this without fear of reprisal, this a similar situation without fear of reprisal or lawsuit. And certainly the university has done absolutely nothing to support the problems that I've been having since that time with the company. In fact, actually, I would view the current administration as considering, I don't know if you saw the recent report in Saturday Night Magazine.
No.
It was a description of what the university considered this case, and they consider it a simple distraction, or are quoted as saying it appears to be something like a simple distraction. It's a fundamental case of academic freedom, but it clearly, I don't think, has been, doesn't appear to have been recognized as such by the current administration. So, no, I don't think major changes have taken place.
In two thrusts, in two ways, protection of patients and also in terms of drug company influence on drug trials?
Well, that's a big question, and obviously something you've been interested in this series and addressing. I mean, do I see any evidence that drug company influence is decreasing at the University of Toronto? I see none whatsoever, no evidence at all that it is decreasing.
Now, there's a four-part question that comes up for me in terms of ethical implications of this conflict or this process.
Mm-hmm.
One for you as a medical researcher, one for the hospital itself, one for the University of Toronto, and one for Apotex. Do you wish to comment on any or all of those?
Sure, I'm happy to do that. Let's take the investigator first. I mean, I think there's a whole lot of evidence now that individuals who are supported by industry in their research tend to give more favorable views about the drug or biotechnology that they are working in. In other words, if I'm supported by industry, I may be much more likely to give the industry view of the favorability of this drug. Whether or not I know I'm being influenced or not, whether or not I believe I have a conflict of interest or not, it's still going to happen. So I think for all of us to say, oh, well, I can't be bought for X or Y is naive. I think that people are bought for things we'd all be surprised at, and I think that that's the main reason I would oppose direct funding to investigators from industry. I don't object to the involvement of industry in development of drugs, but it should be much more hands-off, arm's length than it is. With respect to the hospitals and universities, I'll take them as a collective. I mean, these are public institutions. They have a public duty. They have a duty to the public. They should not be running trials for drug companies, giving drug companies the benefit of public money at the ultimate benefit of private corporations. In other words, if Ralph Nader calls this the socialization of losses and the privatization of profits, and that's exactly what it is. For a very small fee, really, drug companies can use the brains and the technology and the laboratories of public institutions to do trials that they are interested in doing, to ask questions that they are interested in asking, and often to get the answers that they are interested in getting. It's not independently derived or funded or published research. So I think there is a duty for universities and hospitals to recognize this. It doesn't appear to me that we're going in the direction of improving the situation. And finally, in terms of drug companies, I'd like to stay off the specific drug company in this case, but in general, I do believe they have a duty to the public. They're not just in the business of making newsprint or filing cabinets. They're doing a service in commodities that affect human lives, and they make a huge profit and have enormous tax advantages. And so they do have a responsibility. To leave it as saying, well, business has to make a profit, does not cover it. It's a violation of a responsibility, and I don't see that improving either.
You don't have to comment on this if you don't want to, but the U of T is probably one of the top-notch research institutions in the country in terms of medical research, and I find it odd and curious that they attempted to discredit you, and also they rescinded an offer of employment to David Healy when he made comments about Prozac.
Right.
And Prozac, the maker of Prozac, is one of the big contributors to research at the U of T.
Correct. I think that you're quite correct. It does speak for itself.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a longer list than this, but I've been told that the classic response is divide, delay, deny, and discredit. And discredit is the most important thing you can do, because if you can make the person look as if they're whatever, unbalanced or difficult, or if you can do that, and a lot of effort's been put into that in both the cases you cite, then it kind of lets the perpetrators off the hook. So, I mean, it is a very difficult thing to do, and most people find it very difficult to go through something like this, as I know I did and David Healy did as well.
You must have felt very much alone, Dr.
I wasn't alone, really, because I had a circle of very close colleagues who have since then, well, essentially have ruined their own, or derailed, I should say, their own careers for the importance of academic freedom and patient protection. And many of them are professors at the University of Toronto, some at the Hospital for Sick Children, some nationally and internationally. So I was luckier than most because I had a great deal of support here from my closer colleagues. But it is a very isolating and frightening experience. And when the Olivier Report came out last year, we thought, oh, good, it's really a final record and everything's referenced and there really is virtually no sentence that doesn't have a reference or a bibliography or a reference to back it up. And yet none of the recommendations that have been put forward in that volume have been acted upon by the hospital or university.
Committee of Inquiry Chairman John Thompson said that a series of misrepresentations and misjudgments compounded the problem. Would you like to comment on those?
I'm sort of overwhelmed by trying to do that because it's such a a very simple story once, in that all I wanted to do was tell the patients that there was some problem with the drug and that they should know it and they were free to continue. Once the trials were abruptly terminated by Apotex and the cover-ups started on both sides, there were... Well, it's very difficult to sort of summarize that. I mean, I think that the Olivier Report's a difficult volume to get through, and only because of its length. It's very clearly written. There is a very useful summary written by Margaret Somerville, a 5-page summary of it, which does set out what actually happened, because it's a good synopsis of the report.
Now, you got a lot of media attention. Was your situation that unique?
I actually don't think it's unique. For one thing, I wasn't as isolated as many people are. I know personally several people who have been in my situation who haven't had a very determined cadre of colleagues who would not give up and would not stop fighting and would not... My colleagues are fairly fearless. It's very, very easy to become fearful and worry about your job. In fact, I was dismissed 4 times before finally being reinstated. So that is extremely unnerving experience for an academic, and to be derailed on your career when you're still relatively young is something that most people would not take up willingly. So a lot of people are silent, and there's a surprisingly long and broad literature on that term whistleblowers that's been applied to people like me, and there is a general failure rate of over 80%. These people usually lose their jobs, they may lose their families, then they're personally, professionally, and financially destroyed. So you read about these people, but you don't usually see their lives becoming successful or renewed. It's a very serious situation. It's so much I could tell you about that. I did a thesis on this at the University of London just this last year, and it's very sobering.
And the thesis was on?
Whistleblowing, the legal and ethical implications of whistleblowing.
Tell me, did the public attention help you or hinder you, do you think, in your eventual vindication?
Well, that's a good question. I think that there were good things and bad things about that. The one good thing that was very reassuring, I think, to my colleagues and myself was that when people heard this story, if they didn't have an apparent reason not to understand it, they got it in a heartbeat. You explain it, and patients and parents and people on the street understand what happened and don't say, oh, I just don't understand why this happened or this happened. That's the kind of stuff we got from people within the university and hospital, because things had been, as John Thompson pointed out, so enormously twisted. But the straightforward story was there was a problem. That problem has since I certainly raised it been confirmed in other studies. I wanted the patients to know about it. They weren't only the subjects of my trial. They were actually my patients for whom I remain responsible. I had to tell them the truth, and that was the issue at the beginning. So when sort of a situation like that is presented to the Canadian public, they're a smart public. They understand what the problem was. So that was helpful because, in the end, that's all it was all about.
Would you like to talk about the most difficult or the most satisfying parts of this experience for you?
The most difficult, I think, was living, it's probably right now, when the uncertainty of whether all those years meant any difference to the issues of patient protection, scientific integrity, research conduct, and the influences of corporate interests on research. And the difficult part is thinking, you know, we went through all this, we were harassed, there was a hate mail incident when a professor of pediatrics sent 8 months of hate mail to my colleagues, anonymous, threatening or harassing hate mail, found out by DNA. It was a high drama for a while. Was it worth it? Did we change anything? If we didn't change anything, then that's the most difficult part of it. If we did, then one can take almost anything if we think things have changed for the good. And I guess the best part of it was just the support from my colleagues, the recognition that even though there were plenty of people here who acted, in my view, in a disgraceful way, there were still the inspiring stories of people who really, despite everything, stuck to their guns, supported the causes I've described, were very true to themselves, and were utterly fearless in their fight against big power. As bad as it is, those people exist, and I wouldn't have known they existed unless this had happened.
Can you tell us how it's been for you since then, since in these past 6.5 years, and especially now? How is it for you to do your research in that environment?
Well, as I mentioned, I've been on sabbatical for the last year. As a matter of fact, I came back on the weekend. So I'm just now sitting down and starting to write another grant in thalassemia. And I think it's it'd be foolish to say that this kind of thing doesn't make you wonder if there's any real merit in the system of research and if there's any real responsibility of ourselves to the public. I mean, it doesn't seem to me now that the whole system is a meritocracy. In other words, that the best and the hardest working and the most important work gets done. It seems to me that what can be buried will be buried. It's clear that research misconduct can be hidden, obfuscated, that there are important issues that can be just ignored, and that the powers that be may not have all the interests that the public thinks they have. Hmm. And so the difficulty for me is that when you lose faith in a system in which you've worked for 20 years and in which you believe, well, you know, there are always going to be difficulties in any system, but the basic system is right, I'm not sure the basic system is right. I think there's a lot of personal gain. There's a lot of personal ambition. There's a lot of vying for publications that may not really make any difference to patients. A lot of work done that is kind of in me too drugs, not in drugs that are going to have big impact in important parts of the world, such as malaria and things like that. There isn't a lot of interest in diseases in emerging countries. And to me, I guess if you primarily go into medicine to help help patients, then I'm kind of recognizing that's not really what it is about. I'm sorry to sound so absolutely down about that, but I have to say that I just don't think that's what the system's about anymore.
Dr. Nancy Oliveri spoke to us from her office in Toronto. For an alternative view of medical and scientific issues, try the Red Flags Weekly website at www.redflagsweekly.com. That's www.redflagsweekly.com.
For further discussion of ethical issues related to pharmaceuticals, try the Pharmacoethics website at www.pharmacoethics.com. Again, that's www.pharmacoethics.com.
This is a mean old world to live in all by yourself. This is a mean old all by yourself. Oh, yes it is. This is a mean world in which to be alone. without a friend, kindred, or even a home. This is a mean old world to live in all by yourself. What you should do is try and make at least one friend each and every day. Oh, yes. You should try and make at least one friend each and every day.
Third world countries, clinical trials backed by big drug corporations are the only way many patients can get any formal health care at all. Too many poor and undertreated patients and not enough patient protection results in widespread exploitation of these vulnerable populations for research programs that would never be carried out in developed countries. Dr. Peter Lurie is Deputy Director of the Public Citizens Health Research Group based in Washington, D.C. As an investigative journalist and medical expert, Dr. Lurie has broken a number of stories of human rights abuses and misconduct in drug company-funded research in third world countries. Judith asks Dr. Lurie about some cases that he has uncovered.
Third World Traveler website reports that a group called Discovery Laboratories planned to give salt water or air placebos to 325 deathly ill premature infants in a clinical trial of a drug called surfaxin, with the argument that in Latin American hospitals where the drug trials were taking place, the patients couldn't afford effective drugs anyway. What can you tell us about this?
Well, at issue was a drug called surfactant, which is one of the most well-studied drugs in pediatric care. It's been shown to save many, many lives in multiple clinical trials that have been well-conducted, and everybody agrees it's a major advance in clinical medicine. The way it works is when you have a critically ill infant, usually a premature one, they have a deficiency of this chemical called surfactant in their lungs. Usually the infant is on a respirator, meaning on a breathing tube, and what happens is you squirt the medication down the tube deep into the lungs of the infant, and it helps to open up the infant's lungs so that they can breathe normally. And so it's been an enormous benefit. Now, at the time that the Discovery Laboratory controversy happened, there were four surfactants approved for use in the United States and most likely in Canada as well. But the problem was that this Discovery Laboratory wanted to develop a fifth one, one that there's no particular reason would be any better than the previous four. And the previous four not only worked very well, but for the most part they were unavailable to all but the very richest people in developing countries. And so the idea came forth that instead of doing the study in the United States or Canada, where you would have an ethical obligation to provide the active drug to the infants, the idea was you could go to some developing country, not the rich part of a developing country where people would actually have had access to the medicine, but rather the poor part of a developing country where they would not, and then justify comparing the drug not to one of the four known effective medications, but instead against salt water, against nothing at all. And that's what they plan to do.
Now, evidently, the problem of finding parents of dying infants who are desperate enough to risk being assigned to a placebo group could obviously be overcome by exporting the trial to impoverished Latin American hospitals. What comment do you have?
Well, sure. I mean, if you imagine you're the mother or father of an extremely ill infant in Latin America, where they may not even have ventilators, and they, you know, most likely don't have surfactant, either the new or the old. And then somebody comes along to you and says, look, we're going to do this study. Look, we'll never do the study this way in North America because it would be completely unethical. But I'm going to give you a 50% chance of getting a drug that you have otherwise no way of getting. Well, you might say to yourself, look, doctor, you know, I think you're a disgrace for exploiting me this way. But if you're the parent of such an infant, you'd sign up for a study because at least you stand a 50% chance of getting the drug. So, you know, that is put forth by the defenders of such trials as evidence that some good is being done. And in a sense, it is. But the job of doctors is not to do some good. It's to do the most good that they can. And in this case, it's so small of an effort for them to actually provide the drug to people. I mean, by the time they've got around to upgrading the intensive care unit so that they can put in a ventilator, by the time they've brought in the ventilator, by the time they've put the patient on the ventilator, they've already done a lot for the patient. They've got a pretty fancy ICU, but all they won't do is squirt the medication down the tube for the half of people who are assigned to get placebo. That's how exploitative the study is. But from the patient's point of view, it still would make sense to sign up. That's called exploitation. The right way to do this is to compare the new kind of surfactant to the old kind of surfactant and see if it's about as good. That way, more people benefit.
Now, what makes the third world, outside of people being willing to accept not having medication squirted into the tube at the right moment, what makes the third world a good place to test drugs?
Well, from the company's perspective, there are lots of advantages. It's often cheaper to do the study there. For certain conditions, they're just much more common than they would be in North America. If you want to study pregnant women with HIV, there are far more such patients in parts of Africa than there are in this country. And also from the company's point of view, you can reimburse them less, although I suppose that's a relatively small cost. But there are lots of patients who will not have been exposed to other drugs. Of course, that's a public health disaster. The drug companies see it as an opportunity because the more patients have not been exposed to previous drugs, the more the results of any study in which they are enrolled can easily be interpreted. So they like the so-called naive patient, that's a phrase that companies actually use, which has the ironic effect of emphasizing to what degree the patients very often don't know what's going on in the trials.
And the companies evidently get tax breaks, they get building facilities, there's no required testing on animals, there's no institutional review boards.
Well, you know, all of those things can exist to greater or lesser extents depending on where you're doing the work. But certainly in some countries, the institutional review boards, which are the ethics committees that in the United States or Canada would be required to review such studies. By the way, it's not as if these are foolproof organizations. I mean, after all, many of those organizations actually approved some of the studies that we've objected most strongly to. But nonetheless, it's better to have them than not to have them. In many developing countries, certainly not all, but in many, the ethics review infrastructure is very, very weak, if not lacking entirely. And in the well-known study involving Trovan in Nigeria, not only did they not actually have ethical approval, although they claimed they did, they actually apparently went to the extent of actually backdating documents to give the appearance of approval when, in fact, there was none. We've had similar examples in other studies that we've been involved in which committees without quorums have voted in favor of studies. So we think that there's a lot of game playing that goes on with the ethics committees when they exist. And the ethics committees themselves are operating under severe conflict of interest because very often they're at institutions that are extremely poor, that can only bring in foreign currency by agreeing to do research. So there's a tremendous incentive for the ethics review committee to agree for the study to go forward. They're in a very, very weak negotiating position to say, oh, well, yes, but not with that placebo design. That's not very often the way it's going to turn out.
How much, in general, how much clinical testing of new drugs is being exported overseas?
Well, there are very, very little data on this question. The number of clinical investigators registered with the Food and Drug Administration has increased dramatically over the last decade. And so we know both from those data and just anecdotally that clearly the companies are going overseas more and more for the reasons that I outlined previously. But there are no good data. In fact, there are no good data, at least speaking for the United States, on the number of experiments that go forth. There are no good data on the number of people in those experiments, and there are not even particularly good data on adverse events that happen during those experiments. There probably are better data on what goes on in animal testing than what there is in human testing. So the data are poor domestically, and almost by definition, they're going to be even poorer abroad. We just don't know what's going on out there. Of course, that's an opportunity for the companies.
So we don't know either what kinds of drugs they're testing.
Well, what I mean by that is there's no central repository for that information. Now, you know, there'll be particular companies that know it. There may be particular agencies that know some of it. But there's no place that knows all of it. And the public certainly knows very little at all.
'90s, evidently, the National Institutes of Health and Center for Disease Control funded studies in which Western scientists withheld treatment from HIV-infected pregnant women in developing countries, even though they knew that antiretroviral drugs would reduce the rate of HIV infection in these unborn infants by two-thirds. What was the result there?
Well, one of the results was that the infants died, as was completely predictable from the way the study was designed. You see, what happened was, in the early 90s, an experiment was done in the United States and France in which HIV-positive pregnant women were assigned to either get AZT, which was then not known to be effective for this purpose, or else placebo. It was a legitimate study. Nobody knew if it worked. As long as you don't know if something worked, it's legitimate to randomize people to either get placebo or the active drug whose effectiveness you're seeking to demonstrate. That's fine. They did the study. Dramatic two-thirds reduction, the reduction that you refer to. But now the problem was that it cost about $1,000 to give this drug. It had to be given, well, it was given in part intravenously, and it was given for a pretty long time before the pregnancy, you know, was terminated, in other words, before delivery. And so the question became, could this regimen be given either from a logistical point of view or from a financial point of view in developing countries? So they decided to try and provide a little bit less AZT prior to delivery, to switch from intravenous to medication by mouth for that portion of it, which was while the woman was actually in labor, and see if that worked. But instead of comparing it to the regimen that had been proven so effective in the United States and France some years before, they decided that since these people in general would be getting nothing, it was perfectly fine to compare it to nothing. And that's what they went and did, even though they knew that the other regimen worked extremely well with very modest toxicity and that they would save the lives of these infants. And instead, they chose not to do so in the name of science. Now, we objected to this. These were studies funded by the American government, by various European governments, even by the United Nations AIDS program. And it caused, you know, quite a stink. And by and large, the researchers defended the studies. There was some redesign of the studies as time went on. But what I think is very interesting is to see how the researchers, just 3 years ago or so, claimed that there was no obligation to provide these medications to people simply because people were poor and would otherwise not have had access to them. Yet now, you know, just 2 years ago in Durban, South Africa, now we see this clamoring to provide three drugs outside of clinical trials, in some cases, to HIV-positive people, where the benefits are far less clear than they were in the situation with the pregnant women. It's just fascinating. All that time they spent defending not providing drugs that they could have gotten for free from the drug companies, and now here we are just a few short years along, and the whole atmosphere has completely changed. We think that this vindicates our position.
Now, two representatives, one from the National Institute of Health and another from the Center for Disease Control, said that since none of these study subjects could have afforded the drugs, they were under no unusual risk by being assigned to a placebo group.
Yeah, that's just not good enough. I mean, I don't think as a doctor you should be looking at your patients or subjects in quite that way. You know, really, it's not enough to say, well, they're no worse off because we were here. That's not good enough. The question is, as a physician, have you done the most that you can for those patients? The fact of the matter is that those patients came in, they knew they could have saved the lives of many of those infants, and they stared them in the eye, randomized to a group that they knew was inferior to what they could easily have provided, and they let them die. That's outrageous. That is it. And to use the fact that they were poor as the excuse is frankly reminiscent of the Tuskegee experiment in the United States, in which people were denied access to treatment for syphilis for a number of years. It's not dissimilar in a number of crucial respects, in particular that there was no effective therapy. They continued to see the patients in an ongoing way. They knew they could have benefited them, and they chose not to. And the excuse was the same. These people wouldn't have gotten anything anyway. They're poor. They're no worse off because we were here, and that's all we have to do. Nonsense. That's just not good enough.
As an advocate for human rights in healthcare, how do you reconcile the need for ethical standards in drug trials in third world countries with the need for health research in those countries?
The only reasonable kind of research and the only research worth doing is ethical research. The people on the other side of this debate are very fond of creating the straw person, which makes it seem as if all research will come to some crashing end because of the restrictions that we are asking for. That's what we hear every time anybody asks for added restrictions on research. The better way to do it is to go forth and do it in a proper and ethical way. That way you don't risk alienating people in developing countries who might otherwise participate in your study. You don't, you know, risk having unnecessary harm done to people, undermining the research enterprise in general. There is not really a tension between those things. All we're saying, we want research to go forth. We're worried about these HIV-positive pregnant women and their as-yet-unborn infants. We're worried about these infants who could benefit from a drug that would help them, you know, because they're premature and have difficulty breathing, as was the case in the Suffaxin trial. We're worried about them. But if you're going to do the research, do it right. Do it the proper way. Do it the ethical way. In general, do it the way that you would do it at home.
Have you noticed any initiatives in the direction of self-policing on the part of pharmaceutical companies or governments?
Look, the only thing that gets the pharmaceutical industry interested in self-policing is when they're threatened with non-self-policing, which is to say with regulation or with public condemnation. And that's the currency of what we do over here. We try to get, you know, media attention for people who are behaving badly. We try to get regulation whenever that seems to make sense. And usually what happens is the industry will react by saying, we'll take care of the problem. Well, sure, they've taken care of the problem. Here's what happened. What clearly happened in these studies is they violated what was then the Declaration of Helsinki. It still is the declaration, but it's since been revised. Well, they wrote the rules originally. Then they got caught breaking the rules. So instead of bringing their behavior in concert, you know, with the rules, which precluded providing drugs that were known to be ineffective, like a placebo, when there was known to be something that was effective, particularly when it's for a life-saving condition, particularly when it's with an infant. Knowing that they had broken the rules, instead of changing their behavior to comport with the rules, they set about changing the rules to comport with their behavior. And there was a systematic attempt by the research industry to go from research code to research code and water them down so that the research that, you know, we thought was unacceptable in the studies in Africa with AZT now became acceptable. Now, fortunately, people have reacted. There's been a lot of resistance to it, and in some cases, they actually failed. I mean, they failed so dismally that the research rules, and they're rules not that can be really enforced by any government, they're just really guidelines, they've in fact in some ways become stronger than they were, which is quite ironic. But the intent of the industry has been to water them down. That's the kind of self-policing we get.
Is it correct to assume that the big pharmaceutical companies are trying out first-world drugs on third-world patients in the sense that rich Western countries are glutted with prescription medicines for baldness and obesity, and the rest of the world is lacking access to antibiotics, medication for TB or malaria, sleeping sickness, other tropical diseases?
Well, sure. I mean, here's the way it works. If you're a pharmaceutical company, you know where the money is. The money is where rich people are. The money is in the northern part of the planet. The money is in diseases that are chronic, in diseases that make people uncomfortable, and that diseases that are never cured. Those are the best kinds of diseases if you're a pharmaceutical company. On the other hand, what we really have in the developing world are diseases that are taking lives, that are, when treated, often get cured relatively easily by a modestly short course of antibiotics, you know, such as in tuberculosis or in malaria. And those things, because the patients down there don't have the financial clout, by definition, if the companies follow the economic dictates of the system we live under, then they're very well going to be not producing too many drugs for those people. And sure enough, that's exactly the way it turns out. So, sure, they turn their back on the largest public health threats, and instead they turn to where the markets are. And if the market is in erectile dysfunction with Viagra, if the market is in hair loss with Propecia or anything else, that's where you can be sure they'll put their effort. So, you know, there's no question that that's happening, just no question at all.
Now, Canada's pharmaceutical industry is essentially a feeder industry for the big transnational corporations of the U.S., Europe, and Japan. And in the U.S. pharmaceutical industry, can you give us an idea how much money is being made from research and clinical trials in developing countries?
Well, you know, there's no simple answer to that. What I can tell you, though, is that the pharmaceutical companies have been, for most of the last 10 years, the most profitable industry, no matter how you measure profit, by percent of sales, percent of equity, profit margin, any of these things. Pharmaceutical companies are way ahead of everybody else. Even as the bottom is falling out of the stock market in the United States, the companies are still doing well. So this is a remarkably profitable enterprise.
Now, I wonder if you mind if I ask you a bonus question.
Bonus question.
It has to do with meningitis in the meningitis belt going on right now. In Africa, the region that stretches from the west coast to the Horn of Africa in the east is known as the meningitis belt. In February of 2002, in Burkina Faso, a new epidemic strain of meningitis, known as Burkina W135, infected more than 12,000 people and killed almost 1,500, according to the World Health Organization. And the only vaccine that protects against W135 costs up to $50 a dose. Now, there's a threat to as many as 200 million people, with 140 million in Nigeria alone, and a possibility of hundreds of thousands of cases and 10,000 deaths. Now, the WHO is evidently urging pharmaceutical companies to make an affordable vaccine available. But at least one epidemiologist from the Red Cross says there are no vaccines available this year. Why are vaccines not available to help these people who have meningitis?
Well, the problem that they have is that they have the wrong strain. What they need to do, if they're going to get meningitis, they need to get infected with our strain, because there's a vaccine for our strain, even though meningitis is relatively uncommon in the United States and Canada. They just don't have the right strain, and that's the problem. Why is it that there's a vaccine for their strain, not for their strain, rather than one for ours? Well, because the money is here and the money isn't there. That's the problem. It's a special case of what I described before with regard to malaria and tuberculosis, just refined to being within a single disease. We've seen this before. In the first decade of AIDS vaccine research, all of the research that was done was based upon American and European strains of HIV, even though 90% of the strains are quite different from that, and a vaccine that works against one may not operate against another. Where are those 90% of infections? Well, they're in Africa, they're in Asia, they're in Latin America, they're in the Caribbean. But all of the research gets done on the American, North American, European strains. It's just disgraceful. It's totally out of whack of what's needed from a public health point of view.
Dr. Peter Lurie, Deputy Director of the Public Citizens Health Research Group, spoke to us from his office in Washington, D.C. The Public Citizens Health Research Group website is full of revelations about drug industry doings, both around the world and close to home. Their website is at www.citizen.org. Again, that's www.citizen.org.
In Africa, women and girls are bearing the brunt of drug industry and rich country governments' indifference to human suffering. Stephen Lewis, UN Special Envoy for HIV/AIDS in Africa, spoke to an English Montreal School Board adult education conference in January 2003. Here's an excerpt from his remarks.
There are 26 million people in sub-Saharan Africa between the ages of 15 and 49 who are infected. 15 million of those people are women, 58%. There are 8,600,000 people between the ages of 15 and 24 who are infected. 67% of them are women and young girls. It's the ultimate reality that gender inequality is fatal. Young girls having to submit because they have no sexual autonomy, they can't tell a man to wear a condom, they have no independence in sexual relationships. These cultural realities, which are writ large in the world, inevitably take a terrible toll. And globalization, the shrine at which so many worship, is simply incapable of responding. It's even incapable of responding to the extent that the rich nations will provide the money to buy the drugs to keep people alive. Forgive this personal aside. You know the toughest part of playing the role on HIV/AIDS? It's all the young women you meet in their 20s who come to you with their children in tow. And they say urgently, eloquently, what's going to happen to our children when we die? They're in their 20s. And they look at you, they don't use this language, but they look at you and they effectively say, you, Mr. White Man, you have drugs to keep your people alive in your country. Why can't we have the drugs to keep ourselves alive? And of course, there's no answer to that question, because the double standard which exists in this world is egregious. But I just can't get over the fact that one meets these lovely, gentle, moving people. And you know, when you go back 6 months later, that they'll be dead. And that they don't have to be.
Stephen Lewis, UN Special Envoy for HIV/AIDS in Africa, was speaking at an adult education conference in Montreal in early January 2003. In July 2002, reports from UNAIDS and UNICEF predicted a possible 68 million additional deaths worldwide from AIDS, 55 million of them in Africa by the year 2020. For more information, go to www.allafrica.com. That's www.allafrica.com. Next week, media hype in medical reporting. How pharmaceutical companies and other healthcare industry interests are shaping news coverage of exciting new medical products and treatments, and a look at potential health effects of highly touted but inadequately tested gene-based therapies. Our guests will be Dr. Diana Zuckerman, president of the National Center for Policy Research for Women and Families in Washington, D.C., and consumer advocate Colleen Fuller, author of Caring for Profit, How Corporations Are Taking Over Canada's Healthcare System. Our sincere thanks to Nancy Oliveri and Peter Lurie and Stephen Lewis for permission to use his remarks.
Formed and Dangerous is produced by the Community News Collective at CKUT Radio McGill as part of its award-winning Long-Term Memory Radio series. Our thanks to all of those who make educational and inspirational radio here at CKUT possible. Stay tuned for Long-Term Memory Radio each and every Wednesday at 5 p.m. on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on Real Audio on the World Wide Web at www.ckut.ca. This 10-part Farmed and Dangerous series is available in a set of CDs from Radio McGill. For more information, please give us a call at area code 514-398-6788 or visit our website at www.ckut.ca and click on Community News. This is Long-Term Memory Radio.